Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Michael Blanding. He is an investigative journalist, and he's author of the new book, The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So the rise of Coca-Cola is the story of the rise of the American megacorporation. It's the essence of capitalism. How and where did the company begin? And let's get this out of the way. Did it or did it not have coca or cocaine in it?
Yeah, drum roll, please. It did have cocaine in it for the first, about 20 years of its existence. It was created in 1886 down in Atlanta. And it was essentially grew up in this era of what were called patent medicines, when the medicine was very young in this country, and doctors were about as likely to kill you as to cure you from traditional medicine. And so people turned to all these home dosing cures that usually use some kind of exotic formula of herbs and various over-the-counter remedies. And Coke's creator, John Pemberton, created one of these by putting together a kola nut from Africa, which was very high in caffeine, and coca leaves from South America, and sold it for the first 20 years of its existence, that it must have packed quite a punch.
And then afterwards, it became a different formula, but retained its name. And in fact, there were at moments little court battles about whether it was even being true to its name, because it didn't include those ingredients anymore.
Yeah, ironically, that it actually that was its defense in court. They said that it was an adulterated beverage because it didn't contain cocaine. So it sort of shifted the whole thing on its head. But even back in the very beginning of Coca-Cola's existence, it probably didn't have very much of cocaine. Probably the equivalent to a 20th or a 30th of what we consider a modern dose of cocaine. And it was all taken out at the very latest by 1906, when the company really made this kind of brilliant strategic shift, that it decided that by appealing to the masses of people, it could sell a lot more soft drinks than just appealing to those people who happen to be sick or have headaches. And so they really created one of the first kind of aspirational advertising campaigns in history, when they started putting out these advertisements with these very fancily dressed Victorian ladies and top-headed men who were drinking Coke and really presented as this luxury item, even though it was only 5 cents at the soda fountain.
The triumph of the whole phenomenon of branding and advertising is a big part of the story of Coca-Cola, and I have to say that it brings up in me a kind of sadness. Like, there's this one part where you talk about how during, I think it was World War II, soldiers identified Coca-Cola with patriotism, the American way of life, that they were fighting for the right to drink Coke. And I thought, there's a kind of poverty of our culture that our identity is tied up with corporate branding rather than with, say, our music or real food or some way of living. But that's definitely a triumph of this company.
It is very ironic in a way that, I mean, on the one hand, my heart goes out to the soldiers in the foxholes that were genuinely writing these letters back to Coca-Cola headquarters, saying that, the Coca-Cola they had overseas, gave them the ability to go on. And what was really brilliant about Coca-Cola, which really created a lot of modern advertising, is the way that they were able to shift their image to go at the time, starting with this sort of, upscale kind of aspirational image. They shifted to, during the Depression, they were this pause that refreshes. They were sort of this little, time out in your life that you could just be refreshed. And then during World War II, they became very patriotic. And then in the 70s, when, the hippie movement was in full swing, they were teaching the world to sing in this image of international harmony. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but it just becomes very transparent in the way that they use those images in order to essentially sell more and more of this sugary substance that really isn't very good for you in the first place. And you know, they're very quick to disassociate themselves when those images are less positive. For example, in Vietnam, there was no you know, advertising campaign that went along with the Vietnam War, like in World War II. So they really are sort of the chameleon as companies go in terms of how they built their brand, which is just all important to them.
Let's talk about some of the problems caused by Coca-Cola, both in the U.S. and in other countries. One of them is the health of soda-drinking citizens. Of course, it goes beyond Coca-Cola, all of these high-sugar, caffeinated beverages. But they lead not only to tooth decay, but to obesity, to diabetes, also caffeine addiction. Why, then, was Coke able to sign exclusive contracts with a lot of public schools to be the sole provider of vending machine drinks, which meant that kids could get a caffeine sugar drink in the school hallways? They couldn't get milk or juice. How did this happen? How did it play out?
Yeah, I mean, my focus in writing the book was really to look at, you know, what makes Coke unique as a company, at the same time sort of makes it iconic of how companies operate and how, you know, profit motive really drives what they do. And in the case of Coke, you know, one thing we talked about was image and sort of how they crafted their image that was in some ways separate from their business practices. And the other thing was just their relentless drive to growth, which I think more than any company in the world has really founded its business plan on selling more and more Coke and bigger sizes and more places around the world. And they ran into this issue in the late 90s where they were just running out of places to sell the soft drink. At the same time, you know, there was a war going on with Pepsi to really brand consumers when they were very young. And so schools became this hot new market where they could pay a certain amount of money, sign a contract, and the schools would get the revenue that you know, they sorely needed in a time when there were budget cuts and property taxes were falling and all the rest of it. At the same time, these soda companies could really get a hold, and it was both Coke and Pepsi could get a hold in the hallways. And unfortunately, what it led to was one more venue where kids could get these sugary soft drinks, and coincided with this epidemic of obesity and diabetes that I think became more apparent within the last 10 years. But by that point, the damage had already been done, and they were just a fixture in these schools.
But then a very active health instructor in a school in California, in the Los Angeles area, noticed what was going on and brought it to first school and then county or region-wide political battle.
Yeah, this was one of the real success stories that I point out in the book. It's sort of a tempered success story, as we can talk about. But, you know, I really wanted to not just sort of write this book about, you know, the bad things that corporations do, but throughout the book I wanted to thread in these stories of just ordinary people who had been able to raise the alarm about unfair practices or harmful practices. And in this case, one of the people who did this was this school teacher in California named Jackie Domack, who it really started with her at lunchtime with her students, and one of them asking why they couldn't get juice in the vending machines. And from there, she asked the administrators, and they told her about this exclusive beverage contract. And kind of one thing led to another, and she really started this movement that, first of all, got the contract broken at her school and then at the school district, and eventually led to legislation passed in California and this national backlash, which happened about 5-6 years ago, that really led the soda companies to, after a lot of back and forth, to take a step back from a lot of these practices to the point now where they're much less prevalent.
Every step of the way, of course, Coke was fighting and saying, oh, it's not the drinks, it's that they aren't active enough, and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah, one of the things I was really interested in looking at was kind of the corporate playbook that these companies use. And of course, it's not just Coke, but, you know, the kind of classic playbook that was really started by the tobacco companies in the 80s is, you know, first you ignore them and you pretend it's not happening, then you deny it. And in the case of Coke, it was always, you know, it's the couch, not the can. It's the fact that these kids aren't active. And they would sort of sponsor all of these activities at schools in order to try to get kids more active, you know, at the same time that they were selling their soda. And you know, and then eventually they get to this point where they can't ignore it, they can't deny it anymore, and so they kind of go and start a bunch of sort of strategic compromises, a bunch of half steps. Well, we'll remove half of the sugary soda from elementary schools, and then we'll remove all of it from elementary schools, but we'll keep half of it in high schools. And they went back and forth like this for a few years until they were able to finally propose an agreement that was able to blunt the criticism against them. And the agreement that they eventually came up with was one that they signed with the Clinton Foundation that was really, you know, really only went halfway, that it's a voluntary agreement. It doesn't address sports drinks. It doesn't address diet drinks, which people have problems with. But it was enough for them to present the image, at least, that this problem had been solved. And in some ways, the reality that the problem had been solved and we're able to move on from it.
We're talking to Michael Blanding about his book, The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. This phenomenon of getting vending machines that sell Coca-Cola and other Coke drinks into the schools as a way of, on the face of it, helping schools that are strapped for cash basically meet their most minimal budget requirements, like a scoreboard on the athletic field or money for basic programs. That helped me to understand the connection between the conservative agenda of lowering taxes and the corporate agenda, which in this case preys on vulnerable schools that don't have a lot of options for funding. So instead of having a robust public sector that's non-commercial, public institutions like schools then have to turn to corporations to get what should be public needs met. And what gets me about this is that it kind of amounts to another set of taxes anyway, because how much does each child spend per year on Coke drinks?
Exactly.
Let's say
yeah.
50 cents a day, you know, $150 a year per child, which then goes to Coke instead of into
right.
the public coffers.
Right, right. No, it's absolutely true. The studies were done on this where they actually looked at the amount of money that was coming in from these companies, and it turned out to be very little per student. And at the same time, it was really coming right from their pocket money that their parents were giving them every day, and they were spending more on the soda from the vending machines than they would have spent if they'd gone to the corner store down the street. So you begin to see kind of how how cynical this is, that some of these arguments aren't, you know, that seem so so strong up front when you really look at it, are really just the company sort of, you know, really brilliantly coming up with a way to sell more of their product. And I'll give you another example is bottled water, which I look at in the book. I spent a chapter on in the book looking at Dasani bottled water, which is made by Coke and other brands. And that's, the same thing is going on there, where you have this kind of starving of public funds for the maintenance of public water supplies. And so there's this perception, if not the reality, that tap water isn't safe to drink. And then at the same time, people are going down to the convenience store and spending $1, $2, $3 on a bottle of water every day. And when studies have shown that bottled water is not necessarily any better for you or even tastes better for you. So it's this real, you have to hand it to these companies that have figured out how to do these bait and switches.
And with the bottled water, we recently talked on this program about a film called Tapped, which is about mm-hmm. the bottled water industry and so many things wrong with it. We don't have to go into it now, but depleting municipal water supplies
sure.
and the plastic that is from the bottles choking off waterways and oceans, and it just goes on and on. But with the actual Coke beverage, you also have money going into Coke, brand loyalty being formed in these children, and then a higher rate of diabetes and obesity, which again is paid for by the public.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's really, I think it's beyond controversy now, although I think that the companies would obviously still argue with this. But, you know, the studies that have been shown that obviously you can't say soda is completely responsible for this obesity epidemic, but there have been studies that have shown directly that, you know, I think the most convincing one was that for every can of Coke added to a kid's diet, there's 60% chances they have a 60% chance more of a chance of becoming obese. I'm sorry. So it's really, it's not just the fact that they're adding calories to their diet, but it's something about the soda that because they're liquid calories, that people don't compensate them for in other ways. So they'll eat, they won't eat two hamburgers, but they'll have a hamburger with a large size of Coke or another soft drink next to it, which has more calories than the hamburger that they're eating. And so there really is a direct connection there that I think people have really started to be aware of.
As Coca-Cola expanded around the world, and many remember their ad campaign, which associated Coke with world peace and harmony, the consumption of Coke went up a lot in places like Latin America, India, Asian countries. And again, I felt this sadness as I was reading your book about the decline, for example, in India, of drinking tea and yogurt drinks, which are wonderful and which have medicinal properties, and an increase in Coca-Cola, which just isn't very good for you. What kind of health effects do we see abroad?
Yeah, it's kind of like exactly what happened with the tobacco companies, that they ran into problems here in the United States, and so they really shifted their strategy to selling more products around the world. And I think a similar thing has happened with soft drinks, that they reached this point in the last decade where they stopped growing in North America and Europe, and all of their growth strategy now is overseas. And you look at countries like Mexico, which I visited for the book, and they drink, I think it's 600 servings of Coke per year per person. The United States is still right behind them with an average of 400, but it's almost half again as much. And I went to one village in Mexico in particular, which was right in kind of the epicenter of where soft drinks were drunk the most. And it had achieved almost this complete cultural integration in the village, where people would drink, two, three bottles of it a day, big liter bottles of it a day, and go out in the field and work. And they would come home and it was actually used in their religious ceremonies, and they would use it as a form of currency. If their livestock went in someone else's yard, they would have to pay so many bottles of Coke in return. And the health problems are just very apparent. I mean, the obesity, the tooth decay, the diabetes that I spoke to people. And yet, I spoke to a city councilor in the town who had to meet me in secret because, it was just so integrated into this town as this image of America and prosperity that people didn't want to hear it, that it could be having problems. So, they've really been effective, and not only in this country, but around the world.
Another example that you give in Mexico is formerly farming communities in places like Chiapas, where their land has been taken over by oil and mining interests. The people lost their land. Many of them migrate northward. The people who are left behind are women and children, who then have sedentary lives and drink this stuff, and the whole thing is kind of a downward spiral with all these factors coming in from us, from the north.
Yeah, I was fascinated, actually, to learn that and to make some of those connections. You begin to see how some of these problems are related. And there were, a number of people there who really made the connections that, because of NAFTA and because of the land being taken over and not having the farms there anymore, that people would come to the United States and then send back money to people that would basically use it to buy junk food, not just soda, but junk food that was imported from the United States. So you really do see how a corporation can have an amazing effect on people's way of life. And throughout the book, I purposely set out not to paint Coke as evil in some way. There's nobody in a boardroom somewhere in Atlanta who's thinking up ways to destroy people's lives in Mexico or even school kids' lives here. But I think that we don't always analyze the effects that the profit motive has, and I think there's a double-edged sword in that when they do create this image of, like you say, teaching the world to sing and peace, love, and harmony, that it's really hard not to believe that, and it's really hard not to associate this product with all of these, really laudable ideals that then makes it very hard to criticize and really makes it hard to kind of peel away the curtain and understand the effects that it's having.
We're talking to investigative journalist Michael Blanding about his book, The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. on in its history, the Coca-Cola Company and its bottlers became distinct entities. How did this happen? What have been some of the effects on its business model?
Yeah, this was the third reason that I was really interested in looking at Coke. You know, the first one being the image creation, the second one being sort of the emphasis on growth. And I think the third component that really makes Coke fascinating is their franchise agreements with bottlers, which is really unlike any other company, any other major multinational corporation in the world. And essentially, they way back and the very beginnings of the company, the presidents sold the bottling rights for, basically for a song, for $1 or something, and because at that point soda fountains were really it. And at that point, they, it seemed like this big mistake, once bottling started to take off. But it's really been a boon for them in more recent times overseas, when problems have occurred, when pollution has occurred, and in other countries like Mexico or like India, or when there's anti-union violence, as I looked at in Colombia and Guatemala, they're really able to distance themselves from these bottlers and say, oh no, it's not that, it's not us, it's that company, and we have no control over what they do. So they sort of have it both ways, where they make the profits from these bottling companies, but at the same time say that they have no control over them, and it's proved overseas to become very convenient kind of system. Even as in the United States, people have been following the company at all. They recently actually acquired their bottler, and they're no longer a separate entity. So in countries like this one, they actually own all the bottling companies, and across the world, they actually are able to keep this separation that allows them to avoid responsibility for problems.
Sorry, hang on a second. Let's talk about the union situation. You talk about some pretty horrifying stories about union busting and the killing of union leaders in Latin America who were employees of the Coca-Cola bottling companies, and the company's inaction on this. Tell us some of these stories. What do we know?
Yeah, this is what first got me interested in writing about the company in the first place. It was just such a shock to me to think that Coca-Cola, with all its happy imagery, could be associated with things like murder of union members in Latin America. And so I started looking into it, and I focused primarily on a story of this union organizer named Isidro Gil in Colombia, where, Coca-Cola basically came into this situation where there's a civil war going on between these paramilitary groups and these guerrilla groups. They didn't create the situation, certainly. But there's a lot of evidence, especially a lot of circumstantial evidence, that they really didn't protect their workers, and in some ways the plant managers at some of these bottling plants actively colluded with these paramilitary groups to enact violence against union members. In some cases, they were murdered. In some cases, they were put to jail on trumped-up charges for months. And the effect that it had was dismantling the power of the unions at these plants, which, of course, helps the company and their bottom line. So in some cases, it was just inaction, failure to investigate. In other cases, it seems like there was something more insidious going on, at least at the plant level, and it directly led itself to this violence and ultimately to the destruction of the union at many of these plants.
And Coca-Cola very actively tried to discourage people joining unions. When there was a problem, they would require in their contracts that they quit unions, and people who just didn't quit unions, you talk about a story in Guatemala as well, were targeted. They were completely unprotected by the company, and it looks really bad.
Yeah, there's been all these allegations in Colombia for years, and the company, again, they follow this corporate playbook, and they, first denied them, and then they sort of did this series of essentially bogus investigations that really didn't investigate any of the violence. But at the same time, they insist that if anything happened like this today, that they would be right on top of it from the beginning, and they would protect their workers, and this wouldn't happen today regardless. And yet there was this case in Guatemala that happened just a few years ago, in which this worker actually appealed to the Coca-Cola company in Atlanta. And I have copies of emails back and forth in which they, you know, essentially offered him this protection package if he agreed to leave the union and sign an agreement that said that he wouldn't badmouth Coke anymore. And when he refused to do that, they essentially left him unprotected, and he eventually had to flee to the United States. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of talking out of both sides of their mouth, and you know, they were all over the situation from the beginning. That much was true, but they were really all over the situation to protect the company and not protect their workers, and I think that that's pretty telling.
What legal recourse do foreign workers and citizens have against American corporations when they're harmed by them?
There's been a fascinating movement that's happened within the last decade where various parties overseas have used this kind of little-known U.S. law that was originally put together to protect against piracy overseas and essentially gives citizens in other countries standing to sue a U.S. corporation. And there have been a number of victories that have occurred because of the use of this law. And this is the law that the Colombian union workers used to sue the Coca-Cola company over the murders in South America, in Colombia. And as I detail quite extensively in the book, the case had a number of interesting twists and turns, but was ultimately unsuccessful. And there were negotiations that went on with the company in a locked room that I got some confidential documents that really show the level of cynicism of the company and the way that they, you know, again, it was one of these situations where they were going to offer them, you know, just a few million dollars, which is a pittance in these kind of settlements. But they would have to leave the union and promise never to talk about it again, and you know, all these conditions that were put on the money as the union eventually declined. So it was really a fascinating story of this. Unlike the school story where there was a certain amount of success, this was really a unsuccessful attempt by these union members to achieve some kind of justice or even some kind of explanation for what happened, and they were ultimately stymied in that effort.
And one of the tactics that Coca-Cola can always use is stalling indefinitely, just stalling and stalling and stalling, having closed-door negotiations as a condition of that stalling, and just having seemingly infinite amounts of corporate money that can be used for lawyers so that the other side, which doesn't have those resources, is worn down.
Absolutely. And I think that the... especially on this Colombia issue, that the advocates who were really trying to get justice for these workers were very successful at a time, and I think probably scared Coke more than even they realized. Back around 2006, 2007, there was this very strong campaign on college campuses. There was a lot of awareness going on. A lot of campuses, New York University, Michigan, University of Michigan, Rutgers, had actually canceled their contracts with Coke over this issue. It was really starting to gather steam. And this is when the company put out these overtures for these negotiations. And I think that the union made this real strategic mistake where they agreed to suspend their criticism while the negotiations were going on. And they eventually went on for over a year and a half. And by the time they were over and they turned out to be fruitless, the public campaign that had gone on these college campuses and to some extent in churches and other places was really a shadow of its former self. And there have been some attempts to revive it, but I think it was really kind of this brilliant stroke by the company to quell the debate just by stalling and just by taking a long time to act and letting it kind of run out of steam by itself.
We're talking to Michael Blanding about his book, The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. Tell us more about the movement on college campuses against Coke. There were some quite successful and vocal movements in the U.S.
Yeah, this was, you know, again, really another really fascinating aspect that I looked into in my research about the company was just how these citizens that in some ways were, you know, the poorest of the poor, not only in Colombia, but also in India, where there's been a lot of pollution and water depletion at Coca-Cola plants, which we can talk about. But, you know, the really villagers that were in some of the or these poor backwaters of India that were able to reach out to the international community and get attention for the problems that were going on. And in the case of India, they actually ended up closing a bottling plant in this village. And it was just a couple of weeks ago, there was a ruling by the High Court that Coke has to actually pay to compensate the villagers for the pollution that occurred there. And what it really came down to was basic grassroots organizing, that they started on the village level and they eventually got people in the state, and they eventually went national in India, and then found international groups that brought it back to the United States on these college campuses. And it was really this movement on college campuses that really got the company's attention, that back when it was just an issue in India, the company really was able to essentially ignore it or to promise these half fixes. And when it was here in the United States and really threatened their brand with their most important consumers, which are young people, they really had to take notice of it. And again, it's sort of a Pyrrhic victory that they were able to do some things with their investigations that didn't really address the underlying problems. But the upshot was, at least in that one village, the plant was closed, and they're now going to have to pay money to compensate them. So it was a fascinating example of people power and how that can really lead these companies, these huge multinational behemoth companies, to change their practices.
The India example is very interesting because at first villagers in the place where this bottling plant was set up were happy because there were jobs and so on, but pretty soon their well started to run by, and also Coke sold them this sludge, which they said was fertilizer for their fields, and it turned out to kill everything that it touched.
Right, right. And then this BBC investigation came. It actually wasn't an investigation. It was just a story about the bottling plant, and they took some of the fertilizer back to the UK and analyzed, and it turned out it had chromium and cadmium and lead, you know, all of these heavy metals that are carcinogens, and really explained a lot of these issues that these villagers had been saying, you know, from the get-go, that they had these rashes on their skin, that their livestock was dying, that the plants, the mangoes were turning yellow, and they would boil rice in this water and it would turn brown, and these really kind of stark problems they were having that no one would listen to them. And then, you know, finally these tests were done, and it really proved very objectively that there were real problems there, and led to this this call for solutions.
But meanwhile, when somebody, for example, went into the Coca-Cola bottling plant, there was a whole room for water testing, and there was a little tank with fish swimming around in it, and all these things were meant to prove that the water was safe to drink and so on. And later somebody went and looked at that and said, here's why none of this is scientific.
Right,
but to the
right.
layman, you know, even to the journalist, even to somebody with their...
No, to me, yeah. When they showed me that stuff, it seemed... I was impressed by it, and then I brought it back to this sort of public chemical, sort of nonprofit that does a lot of this testing of chemicals, and they showed me that the kind of levels that they were testing for and they were touting really have nothing to do with the contamination in the water. They have to do with the heaviness of the water or other things that really are neither here nor there. So the company, you know, has wised up in many ways, and they've been able to, I think in some ways they actually have cleaned up their act, and in some cases they are just have found better ways to hide it.
Reading this book, it seems to me that education is the ultimate tool. Learning about one's own health, deconstructing corporate branding and advertising, teaching children, protecting children. But it's an uphill battle against the onslaught of relentless corporate messaging.
I think that's really true. I think that's astute of you to say that. I mean, the Coca-Cola company spends $2.8 billion a year just in the United States on advertising, and their budget for worldwide advertising is more than twice that. You know, I think we like to believe that doesn't have an effect on us, that we're educated and that we can see through it. And yet it's very insidious, kind of how it seeps into our culture, and these warm, fuzzy feelings that we all have about Coke and the polar bears and Santa Claus and all of that. It makes us much less skeptical than we should be. And I think you really see the apex of that in this corporate social responsibility movement. That's not just Coke, but everybody has sort of jumped on this bandwagon and are touting, you know, Coke touts the lifestyle fitness programs they have in schools. They tout their environmental initiatives, and they're saving river basins and rainwater harvesting and all of these great things that they're contributing to. But the benefits of the things that they're doing, I think, are really outweighed by the way that branding occurs, and that it really kind of makes us less skeptical and in some ways blinds us to the other things that they're doing that may not quite be so good. And I think that's just a very basic tenet that everything a company do has to improve its bottom line in some way, you know, legally as a public corporation. And so if it wasn't doing that, then they wouldn't be doing it. And I think that it's really easy to lose sight of that as consumers who really want to believe in this image.
It does make one sad. It certainly made me sad that we have to spend so much of our life energy fighting against corporations as they try to exploit us and get us to eat and drink things that aren't good for us and so on, and hide the pollution that they're doing, hide the ways in which they're completely poisoning people in other countries who they think are worthless and so on, rather than living in a, you know, cooperative, non-toxic relationship in which a company really can be a good corporate citizen and an economic driver for a community.
Yeah, and I'd like to say that there was some happy ending on the horizon, but what really makes me sad and what really makes me want to do more of what I do as an investigative reporter is to look at how, in some ways, this is getting worse, that we have, you know, things like the Citizens United decision, which, you know, I think is one of the most dangerous decisions that have come out in the Supreme Court in decades, that essentially gives these corporations even more influence in our society and rather than less. We kind of have tied one hand behind our backs in allowing corporations to be people for all intents and purposes under the law that can buy and sell other companies and, you know, have the same kind of rights that people have. At the same time, we give them a liability protection where, you know, they have all kinds of protections against being sued or held accountable for their actions. So it really, they have all the benefits of being a person without the responsibilities that we all have. And so I think it really is a systemic problem, that it's not just Coke, it's not BP or Halliburton or any of these companies that you could point to. It's the way that the system is rigged that unfortunately doesn't seem to be getting any better and in some ways seems to be getting worse with some of these decisions.
Do you see any countries, any societies that are handling these balances in a better way than we?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think that there are some movements to kind of right this balance, that obviously on business school campuses, corporate social responsibility is all the rage now, and I'm somewhat skeptical of that. But there have been some movements to take some of these social issues into account and a company's bottom line, and to really kind of come up with a different way of measuring worth for shareholders. And then there have been some efforts, you know, specifically around the Citizens United case, where people have been pushing for a constitutional amendment that would repeal that decision specifically, or go even further and really change our idea of corporate personhood, or abolish our idea of corporate personhood. So I do see some of these movements out there that are addressing some of the systemic problems of capitalism. And you know, I'm by no means anti-capitalist, and in the way that I write the book, I'm not, you know, sort of writing this huge anti-corporate screed, but I do think that the system is fundamentally broken in terms of keeping corporations accountable, and I think we see the effects around us, whether it's the BP oil spill, or it's the Massey mine disaster, or it's the egg recall that happened last summer, and we're beginning to see the breakdown of this responsibility. And, you know, these events happen and we all get upset about them, and there's a specific measure that's proposed for that certain situation, but the systemic issues of the way that our system is set up don't get addressed.
We're talking to Michael Blanding. His book is called The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. Michael, what are you working on now?
That's a question. I've been taking a break from book writing, and I've been doing some magazine stories on various issues. But I'm sort of looking for the next big thing, and I'm very interested in some of the ideas that we've been talking about the more systemic issues around capitalism the way it is, and this country, and so I'm interested in finding a way to tackle that in another project. So stay tuned.
Yeah, the other thing, and this is beyond the scope of your book, but it's something that I just keep coming back to, is when you have as you do in all publicly traded companies, the mandate for growth, you're ultimately doing something that is fundamentally unnatural. For example, if you think of an economy as an ecosystem, and you have trees in it that grow from little seedlings to trees, at a certain point they reach their height and they cannot grow anymore, but they can live, they can bear fruit, they can sustain their job, they can do what they do for their entire lifespan. And if you think about a corporation, if there were a system wherein a corporation could reach its natural size and serve whoever it's serving and not have to grow, but we don't seem to have a model for that.
No, I think that's very true, and it is something that I bring up in my book. I mean, Coca-Cola was one of the companies that really started that movement, which really only goes back to the 1980s, where everything really depends on the share price, and corporations are really only looking quarterly at their next quarterly statement to determine their value, and if something doesn't improve their bottom line in the short term, then they won't do it. And I mean, in some ways, I have a lot of sympathy for corporations that have to operate under those set of circumstances that are being punished by these investors on Wall Street that are very quick to pull their money out of one company and put it into another company if they're not, you know, showing these returns, and whatever they have to do that to do that, whether it's, you know, laying off workers or whether it's cutting corners and pollution overseas or what have you, they're going to do. And no, we haven't figured out a way to create a system that is really rewards sustainability or rewards long-term thinking. And you know, we saw that in the financial collapse a couple of years ago, which, you know, in some ways is just a mirror image of these same issues where, again, this short-term thinking and this greed is good philosophy on Wall Street really ended up leading to a major collapse.
It does, I think, point to the very strong need for a robust public, non-commercial sector of our lives. In other words, participation in civil society and democracy in contexts like school, like political parties, and so on, that are fundamentally non-commercial, in which these things can be discussed without the commercial factor being a bias in the way we're thinking about things.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, the danger is always there that, you know, because we've given corporations so much power, it really, you know, these issues get co-opted all the time. You know, as soon as there is a positive movement, a corporation finds a way to make money off of it, and you know, it's debatable about whether or not it waters down the movement, but in many cases it does. I'm thinking about things like Walmart and organics or things like that. But, you know, because these corporations are sort of the default power in our society, they have a tremendous ability to act on things in ways that private citizens don't have. And so I think there's just an incredible tension there that goes on, that whenever you do have a regulation or you have a move towards sustainability, that it can very easily become co-opted.
You portray in your book some activist movements and some individuals who do things like go into Coca-Cola stockholder meetings and disrupt things and take the microphone and tell the truth. How effective are actions like that?
I think in the case of Coca-Cola, I think they were tremendously effective. And you know, I in some ways, I'm a bit critical of it in my book. You know, in some ways, it is this kind of theater that you know, really you're not changing anything. You're sort of just making your statement and going home. And I think if that's all you're doing, then there can be problems with that. But I think you know, a company like Coca-Cola that's so dependent on its image, and I think that's becoming more and more the norm for companies, is that it's you know, the product is really secondary to the image that a company creates. And so any time that you're directly confronting them, or any time you're directly tarnishing that image, I think that it creates incredible panic inside the corporate boardrooms. And I think, you know, the question is, what do they do with that? And you know, do they address it as a PR issue and try to blunt the criticism through those means, or do they actually address the underlying issues and change their practices? And you know, I think that history has shown that there's a very mixed track record on that question. But I do think that some of these public campaigns, if they're done in the right way, if they're targeted in the right way against the company's image, and has some kind of legal, you know, direct legal consequence, there's some kind of teeth there, something binding, that combination can really, in some ways, succeed against really incredible odds and address them as issues with these huge companies.
The natural question, I think, before we end is this question about what ordinary citizens can do. And the complexity of the questions that your book, The Coke Machine, sets up really doesn't point to any simple answers. In other words, it doesn't make any sense to be anti-corporate. It doesn't make any sense to be utterly and completely pro-corporate because of the possibility and the reality of tremendous abuses and health problems and all the things that we've talked about. There are political solutions, but those require a lot of creativity in a context where politicians, on the national level anyway, are by and large supported by these very corporations and have no motivation to be particularly creative about this. Do you see any place where that kind of creative political thinking is going on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wrote this book as a journalist, and, you know, at a certain point, I feel like my role is to expose these practices and to describe the kind of responses that I see to them. But, you know, but obviously I write with a point of view as well, and I think that that it really starts with being aware of what's going on. I really do think that, as you said, education and understanding how the system works is the first step. And then I think the second lesson that I learned when I looked at all of these practices that companies were engaging in that were unfair or unhealthy for consumers, the times when people were successful and really holding the company to account were times when they had both of these things going on simultaneously with the campaign against the brand image and a lawsuit or some kind of agreement, negotiation that really had some teeth behind it and wasn't just voluntary. And really the two parts go hand in hand, that I don't think you can do one without the other, that if you're just doing some background negotiation, there's really no incentive and the company will just stall and stall and stall. But if you're just doing this public image, then it really lends it allows the company to sort of wiggle out and just propose these, like I say, PR-based solutions that really don't address the underlying issue. And so the times when they've been most successful have been times like in India, where they had this you know, huge campaign on college campuses, but they also had these legal proceedings that were going on in the courts in India and were actually able to get some, you know, real teeth behind demanding compensation from the company. So if there's any lesson that I bring away from the reporting that I did on the book, it's really that one. And I think it's, you know, it's up to the individuals to apply it to the specific situation, the specific company, the specific practices that they're trying to address to create that kind of justice.
Michael Blanding is an investigative reporter. He's author of the book, The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the interview.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.